Welcome to Agents of Smooch. We are going to follow the white rabbit because it is time to take the red pill and learn the truth about The Matrix. With the fourth movie coming out this Christmas, it seemed like a good time to revisit the original Matrix trilogy with our particular rose-colored lenses, except they seem to be a bit green in this mission. Not even the most jaded can deny our agency the epic love story of the two coolest pleather-clad, long-swinging, coat-wearing, gun-toting characters. Yeah, we're going to talk about Trinity and Neo and all the other romantic subplots in The Matrix and outside of it. I am director Annette Weirstra, and for today's mission, I am joined by, I think, all Gen X agents, because I think these are the people who love The Matrix the most. And it all started with a tweet from Sarah Bickerton. So hello, Agent Sarah.
Whoa.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, just an idea I had that given The Matrix 4 is about to come out in about a month and a half, I think, it was time. I think we need to go back to The Matrix.
Yes, and we can't do this without Agent Sandra Wong, because I know she has strong feelings about a particular person in this movie.
I have strong feelings about them all. I do.
You won't reveal all your secrets.
No, I mean, I might, but maybe not tonight.
And we also have with us Agent Erica Ensign. Hello, Erica.
Hello. I saw The Matrix, the first one, in the theater 9 times.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Nine times?
Oh, well, I saw it a number of times. I don't remember how many times I saw it.
It was a very expensive summer because it was also the summer that The Phantom Menace came out, which I also saw in the theater 9 times.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
No, this was the most joyous summer perhaps of my entire life. So
I love that. I think I saw the first Matrix movie with my now sister-in-law, and that was the first time I ever met her. Was that the movie? I think that was the movie we went to.
Mm, how do you know she's real?
I don't. I haven't seen her in 2 years. I can't even. Who knows? So in Sarah's tweet, she asked some good questions when I said we should do this, starting with, how does the series stack up so many years later? Because I haven't watched it in a while. I've watched it many, 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 many times, the first one especially. Also, thinking about it from the romantic side, like what kind of romance tropes? And a good question, does Trinity even exist as her own woman outside of Neo and Morpheus? Oh, so yeah, no, this is like a 90s movie. So I think that all these questions kind of write the episode for us, and we're just here to fill in the gaps. But let's start with our general feelings, and why do you think it really hit a lot of our hearts? So let's start with you, Sarah.
It's 1999. I am 25. I'm living in here in New Zealand. And it hit me because it was genuinely new. I remember going to see this in the movie theaters, and I saw the special effects, the concepts. It blew my mind in a way that I hadn't had a film do that since I was a kid and had a kid's kind of expectations of films. And going back and rewatching the original Matrix, it was so good. It was just so good. It was, separate from questions of like, what do we look at it now from a 2021, 2022, lens, it just was really good, and it dictated what was going to happen in so many films afterwards. And I'm going to say controversially, in the 2003 sequels, they're actually not bad. I'm going to put a statement in the ground that I know everybody trashes the sequels. I actually really enjoy them. Are they as good as the original? No. But they are good. And that's where I'll leave it for now.
Do you think, I think that I had that same experience of Mike, it blew my mind the first time I saw it. And I think for people when it came, who didn't see it at that time and are just like, I don't think it hits younger people in the same way because they...
It's not even just an age thing. I can tell you that because obviously it blew my mind or I wouldn't have seen it 9 times. But I showed it to my spouse, Steven, who is 2 years older than I am. And I'm Gen X. So like that's the space that we're coming from. But he didn't see it. And I showed it to him for the first time maybe last year, like very, very recently.
Oh, wow.
No, it might have been the year before. But anyway, it did not land for him. He was like, you know, I can see the things that it did and I recognize that it did them for the first time. But he has seen so many other iterations of the stuff that it started that it just like it didn't have that frisson for him that it did for me. Also, he's not a fan of Hong Kong cinema style like fight scenes and stuff. Whereas I am well known for not liking fight scenes. I get bored, especially if it's gunfights. Like, I am out. That is not my kind of thing. And yet, some of my favorite sequences in the first Matrix movie are the hand-to-hand combat and the fighting scenes. So I think that there's just something special about the way that this movie married the traditions of Hong Kong cinema, which I had already known and loved, with the way that Western filmmakers were making fight scenes boring and managed to like bring out the best in both. So it absolutely blew my mind. And I think, yeah, for younger audiences or for older audiences who didn't see it at the time, it might be a little bit of a tougher sell.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I also saw it in the theater, and I remember seeing it in a super crowded theater. And so I came at this film because I was already a like sci-fi nerd and also a massive Keanu Reeves fan. And I've been a massive Keanu Reeves fan since like Dangerous Liaisons, probably. Aww. I think that was my first Keanu film in the 80s, for those who are not familiar with his actual full oeuvre. So I was just open. I had no idea what the film was about. My brother, I think, was the one who said, we should go see this. So my husband and my brother and I, the three of us, just tromped down. And Annette and Erica, you may or may not know the Clairview Theaters in the northeast of Edmonton. So I still remember that. Anyway, I just remember going, I don't really understand. I can't really follow every single thing that's happening in this film right now. But it's like so fascinating to me. You know, because I did have some trouble following the plot at first and everything that was going on. Because it was just, I was just so, I guess, like just blown away. Like, I'm like, okay, so visually that's so cool. And like, what's happening again? But I've seen it many, 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 many times since. And I'm with you, Sarah. I actually never hated the sequels. I thought they both worked well for what I thought was the central theme about the trilogy. And I've said this before, and I think I said it on the Twitter conversation. I said, well, I think this trilogy is about love. So for me, it was like, yeah, that totally makes sense. And I mean, my children who are teenagers, so Gen Z, they have watched the film, the trilogy. My husband and I are both like massive fans. So of course they've watched, you know, I think they watched last year, and they maybe had the same reaction as your husband, Erica. Yeah. 'Cause they were just like, that's interesting. And we're like, okay, fine. Okay, whatever.
Don't you just want to take them by the shoulders and be like,
don't you get it? Don't you get it? Oh, well, I do think that, so a couple things. I think the sequels for a lot of people were quote unquote, you know, they're a letdown because they didn't seem as fresh and new as the original Matrix film. And I think part of the reason the original Matrix film, you know, was such a phenomenon was because it was released in 1999. And those of us of this age in Gen X, we all remember that whole Y2K crap going on. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, what? what is going on? What does this mean? Does this mean that everything's going to stop and life is going to end as we know it because computers cannot handle the year 2000 in their processors? What is this? So for people who don't understand Y2K, just look it up. It was a massive, massive scare.
It's hard to describe to people now like just how big it was. I actually worked in IT at the time, and part of my job was prepping for Y2K. So it was...
I also think it was a particular historical moment because we'd had the like the 80s and the move into the 90s, and we'd had that famous the end of history announcement of that we were now in what would be and will ever be the status quo future. And that nothing would change. I mean,
wow, so naive.
I'd like to send an email from 2021, please. It's like we had this generation of Gen X growing up with that everything had been done already, in the sense of history was over. And I remember that line where Morpheus gives Neo that you just think it's the end of the 21st century, and it's like human civilization hit its peak, and he said in reality it's more like 2199, and I think that spoke to like a bunch of Gen X's who felt like nothing had changed. This is just like that the 90s were like this is what it's going to be like for the rest of us, and Bill buys into that Gen X apathy of this is just the way things are.
I mean that might have been the case for me a little bit subconsciously, but I think for me it was more I grew up in a sci-fi household, so I was reading science fiction from a very young age. And my favorite sort of corner of science fiction was always the stuff that dealt with what is the nature of reality. Like The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin was like one of my favorite books, because it's like, what is actually real and how is reality being warped around you and you're not even noticing it happening? And when The Matrix came out, I don't know if you guys remember the promos for it, but there was never an actual trailer for The Matrix that I recall. It was all teaser stuff. So all we knew was that, some weird guy is going to jump over a building and Keanu Reeves is going to say, whoa. And like, that's it.
As he does.
And I was like, I kind of don't care if anything else happens in this movie. That was just compelling enough to me. And then also then it comes up, what is thematrix.com?
Yeah.
And I was just like, the whole marketing strategy of just saying, what is this thing? And not telling you what it is was genius, because it absolutely got me. So my roommate, Jeff, and I went to the movie theater, and we got there late, and I had to sit in like, this is before the time of like the nice stadium seating. And we ended up having to sit in, I think it was the second row, in one of those seats that's all the way on the right side, where there's literally only two seats in that row.
And the worst.
So we were right there. So we're basically like cranking our necks like back as far as they go to be able to look up at the screen. Yeah. And within a few minutes, I didn't know where I was. I didn't care because like it starts and I didn't have any idea what it was going to be going into it. And then in the first few scenes, you have no idea what is going on. All you know is like something's happening with like tapping a phone line. And then this super hot chick is running around in pleather and like jumping off buildings. And like when she says, get up, Trinity, just get up. I was 100% hooked to the movie at that point, even though I still didn't know what was happening. And I think the fact that like the movie brings you along and like explains sort of what the world is as you go, and that whole what is the nature of reality thing, and oh, it's not what you think, completely played into, talking about love, my science fiction love. Like that was that was so right there. And I think that's why I will raise my hand and sadly say I was one of those people who totally put down the sequels, because I saw the second one and was like, oh, because the Matrix had already sort of been revealed. You can't do that, whisking away the curtain a second time. And I think I was just so wanting it to do the same thing again, which is impossible and very sad. Yeah. And then I think I did watch the second movie again right before the third one came out, like 6 months later. So I've seen the second one a couple of times and the third one only once in the theater, and was just like, that's it. Those two don't exist. And I rewatched them for this, and I just want to go back to Erica watching the third movie and just be like, grow the F up. Because, like, they are good movies. I mean, do I think that they could be cut down into one really good movie? Yes. Yes I do. Mm-hmm. But yes. did I enjoy the experience of watching them? Heck yeah, I did. It was fun. And I think the reason that I didn't like the second two as much at the time is similar to how, Sandra, you said you were feeling about the first one, where, like, you didn't quite understand what was going on, but that one is so, like, it grabs you so much that it kind of drags you along. Whereas the second and third one, I had trouble following the mythology of the storyline, you know, people being programs, programs being people, all that kind of stuff. And I didn't quite grok what was happening. And this time I did. And I don't know if it's because I'd seen them before or because I've watched a lot more science fiction since then, or I'm just older and smarter now. It's probably that one. Yeah, I thought they were a great extension and did about as well as you can after having that. Except I have very big problems with the music. You should have stuck to pop songs and not used a score. I'm sorry for the fight scenes. But other than that, I say, if you haven't seen the sequels in a long time, go back and rewatch them because they're way better than you remember.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that I find core about this, about the sequels, is the fact we actually get more of Trinity and Neo's relationship. Mm-hmm. In the first one.
Yeah, you get a relationship. You get a relationship
that just gets handed to you, that they're in love. Boom, done. And I'm like, wait, what? Why are they in love? How did they fall in love? And it's like you actually get to see them be in a relationship in the two sequels. And that gets fleshed out so much more than the first film.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I will say I never bought the chemistry between the actors, but I appreciate the story.
Oh, so interesting. I will say, too, I mean, I have so many thoughts. But, okay, one of the things I want to bring up is that, speaking of romance tropes, so they definitely, you know, Trinity and Neo are – there's that question, like, if you are soulmates, whatever that means, mm-hmm. and you're destined to fall in love with one another, you are meant, you're designed for one another.
The Oracle set it up. Yeah.
So if you're designed for one another, what does that mean in a relationship? What does that look like? And I think that's what the sequels, as you were just saying, Sarah, so eloquently, that's what we get to see. So where do you go from there? Boom, you're in love. That's the trope. You're meant to be together. Is that the end of it? Absolutely not. Because, you know, hell ensues. Then what are you going to do? So I liked that part, you know.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, this is my headcanon, so excuse my headcanon. But I think the Oracle set up Trinity and Neo to fall in love because they'd had six iterations of the anomaly before, and he'd always made the same choice to save the world and not save whatever. And this time the Oracle set the two of them to fall in love with each other so that he, Neo, would make a different choice.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. He made the choice to save the girl. And that was yeah, and I mean, there's other triggers, but that's my headcanon, is the Oracle set up Trinity to fall in love with Neo so that Neo would make a different choice.
That is genius. I love that reading of it so much because like I said, especially in the first movie, like, they're not really doing anything together except kicking ass. So you're not really watching a romance evolve. You're just sort of finding out at the end that, oh, by the way, she's in love with him. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that the Oracle, like, made that predestination, but she certainly planted some seeds to, I don't know, up the chemistry factor a little bit, even though there's no chemistry. But I do feel like in the second and third movie, I appreciate watching them be a couple. And the idea that, yeah, that it actually is love that saves all of humanity in the end because he chooses to go through the other door I love that. From now on, every time I watch it, that's exactly what's going to be in my head. Thanks, Sarah.
I mean, you know, and there's the other trope, too, in romances, which is, how else would I say, like, I would burn the world for you. That's literally that trope. So they threw that one in there too. And then, well, what does that actually look like? Do you actually do that if you have the power, like Neo does, to save, you know, millions of people? Is that what you do? And what does that look like? And so that's another trope to toss into the mix there in their love story. And it's so funny, Erica, I had never actually thought that they don't have any chemistry. But now that you said it, I think I would say that they didn't have any sexual chemistry. But to me, they often, in the characters, they often seem like they were in a relationship that we had already been seeing. Like, we're looking at a relationship that had already been a few years old. So it's not that first blush of, you know, super hot, sexy times. But it is that deep connection. I think they both played that pretty well. Both the actors played that well.
I think it's because I think I was the only thing in the first movie that annoyed me a little bit, because I just loved it so fully, was the fact that suddenly at the end, love conquers all because she kisses him and he wakes up. And like, right. I had to headcanon dance around that a lot in a lot of different ways to kind of make it okay for me that like that a kiss is just going to wake him up. I was like, no, it just took him that much time to realize, you know, whatever.
He's Sleeping Beauty. Yeah, he's Sleeping Beauty.
There is a little bit of foreshadowing for that. Like, because the Oracle, when she first meets Neo, says, "You're not the one." Well, she lets him say that he's not the one.
Right.
And one of the lines that she uses is that, "Yeah, kid, I'm sorry. Maybe in the next life, you'll be the one." And the thing is, he dies and
That's
then
true.
Gets reborn through Trinity's crit and becomes the one.
I think I was just annoyed at, like, just a kiss from somebody who, like, I think I felt, not cheated, because I didn't feel cheated out of it, but when there's a love story, one of the things that I like the most in romance is watching the romance blossom. And there's none of that.
Yeah.
There's absolutely none of that. And that's, you know, that's a choice that they made, and that's totally, you know, their choice as the directors. That's fine. But for me, it didn't play quite right. But I totally agree with you, Sandra, that by the time we get to the second movie, like, that is a couple that is, like, they are working in tandem. They are partners. I absolutely believe that. I believe that they are partners working together. But I never, like, I feel like the characters who are people in the Matrix who feel so uncomfortable with this fake life around them that choose to leave it are all people who are kind of weirdos and loners and outsiders, which obviously, you know, we Gen Xers, many of us really got echoed with a lot.
Yeah.
So I feel like it made sense for all of those actors to play the characters as a little bit stiff, a little bit wooden, a little bit standoffish, because it totally makes sense within the context of the films that we're seeing. But that also means it's real hard for me to see them interacting with each other and read that as something that resonates with me as a romantic connection. So I did appreciate them as partners in the later movies, but I just, especially the sex scene, which I was just like, same time you have like the big sweaty dance going on, and
which Steven, was great. Yeah.
Steven just leans over to me and he goes, "Oh yeah, this is the Wachowskis that did Sense8, which is a show that we completely stopped watching because we did not enjoy it. But you know, I was like,
Erica, I hated that show. I couldn't even finish the first episode.
I could not get into it. I just couldn't. It's too much.
I'm going to make a pitch, BNF. Though, about the first movie, because part of the trouble is, I think, Trinity spends a lot of time thinking, I'm supposed to be in love with this guy.
Yeah.
If he is the one, do I feel in love with him? Is he the one? If he's not the one, am I not in love with him? If I am in love with him, does that mean he is the one? And so it's like, I feel like a lot of her thinking is like trying to figure out not even how does she feel about her, but how she feels about him then it like enact in the whole prophecy, which just sometimes she just seems really confused in terms of like, I don't know.
This is excellent headcanon, and I appreciate it, and I think it's going to improve every future viewing. But like, I could send you guys a lovely article about how the whole idea in writing of show don't tell is bollocks and very gatekeepery. But But, and I feel like that this, in this movie, they didn't do it either. Like, they didn't show me that that was going on in Trinity's head. And she certainly didn't tell anybody that. So if I would have had that thought earlier, and like, now I just feel like a failure as a viewer because I didn't think of that.
No, I know better. I mean, like, honestly, their best chemistry is in the elevator scene with all the guns.
That's right.
When they're like walking in the iconic moment with that music, and it's like, I freaking love that section.
There's so many times through the first film where Trinity is this close to telling Neo that she's in love with him, but she doesn't, and she pulls back, and you're like, why aren't you? It's like my immediate thought was like, do you not want to tell him that you're in love with him? But I think Annette's idea that she's confused and can't say it because she doesn't know. And it's not that she can't tell him that she was prophesied to fall in love with him, but she doesn't know if she's in love with him. And and it's really not until the end that she figures it out.
I think maybe it might have helped me, Erica, like me believe it so easily because it was like, well, that's Keanu Reeves. So, I mean, have you seen him? Are you looking at him? Because honestly, what's the confusion?
But I will say that, you know, talking about maybe another romantic couple, I love Harold Perrineau. I think he is just fantastic. I've always liked him a lot. But him playing Link, coming in, first of all, I was very upset that Tank died off screen after the first movie.
Yeah.
It's like, no! But then he has a really cool brother who, and I thought that relationship between him and, was it Persephone that was his wife?
Oh, gosh.
No, Persephone was the Merovingian
sister-in-law.
Wife.
Merovingian, yeah.
Oh, yep. Okay, yeah,
yes,
yeah. Anyway, I can't remember.
Yeah, me neither.
Maybe it was his wife. Anyway,
I can't remember anyone's names because there's so many of them.
But I thought that their relationship was all of the nuance and the coupliness and the overt feelings that you couldn't necessarily get from somebody who was pulled out of the Matrix, because, you know, they're the homegrown Zion humans who had never been in the Matrix. So, of course, they'd been having these messy relationships for their entire lives. So it's just spilling out all everywhere. So I really liked watching Link come home and basically immediately have a fight because he's going to go off again with, you know, Morpheus, who is the creepy old weird dude who believes in something that not everybody believes in. And she doesn't know if it's real. And then she decides to fight her own battle by literally fighting a battle. She's like, that's the relationship that I really was able to hang my hat on romantically.
Well, and her line where she, like, her sister-in-law, Gina Torres, who I love too, she says, like, we've got to evacuate. And she goes, no, I'm not going to evacuate because if it were him, he would stay and fight for me if he was, you know, he would do that. And I need to be there. And I'm like, oh, that's good. I like that. Just go out there and you fight. And then she was so great.
Yeah, and the way she turns it around on Gina Torres's character, Cass, like, you know, if it was Dozer, if he was still alive, would you do it? And then you see her face go, oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally. I totally would.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things I liked about the sequels, too, is that we actually had more women characters.
And they were awesome.
And they were awesome. Yeah.
I'm going to call it the second movie because there's sort of one movie. It's just the thing. I like them too. I think Sarah's exactly right where they're just, you cannot have the same experience of the first movie. And ultimately watching them again, I'm like, they're kind of in a different genre of movie. Like they're still sci-fi, but now you're getting world building. You're getting like epic battle. You're getting all of this other stuff sort of like with the layer of the Matrix over top of it. And a lot of it is a lot more familiar. And yeah, it's like, I like it, but it's just, you don't have the same experience in it. And you just get, like, there's also a bazillion more characters.
I have to say, too, for the second movie, I have watched the second one so many times as well. And every time that one super long extended chase scene on the freeway happens, I know what's going to happen at the end. I know exactly what's going to happen. And I still tense up. And I'm still like, oh, my God, every time. I just love that scene so much.
oh no, that's when I would completely cut.
Yeah, no, I love that scene so much.
I mean, to me, I thought it was well done, but to me, it was like one of the things that I liked about The Matrix and that I like about a lot of like sort of first time big movies from directors is I'm getting to do this cool thing, but I don't have all that much to work with. So I am going to make really creative choices to, you know, make it lean and exciting. And then that chase scene with cars on the freeway and stuff was very much, oh, suddenly we have a budget, so we're just going to use it. And then we're really going to use it.
That was something I really noticed transitioning from the first film to the sequels was that, yeah, God, you could tell. Like, watching it on rewatch, it was like, whoa, your budget got quadrupled. I swear, it was just like, yeah, it really went over. And yeah,
there was also way more fight scenes, like so many more.
And I'm going to just complain about the music again. Like, it was like, we have a budget now, so we can hire somebody to write a score, and they can write sort of techno-ish beats behind their score for the fight scenes. And no, it ruins it. It takes away all of the charm that you had in the fight scenes for the first movie. Although I will say, by the time the third movie rolls around, it actually works because most of the fight scenes are not as intimate. You know, the giant battle sequence, you don't necessarily want a pop song for a giant battle sequence. So I just wish that they would have like had, you know, maybe the first two or three fight scenes in the second movie with an actual techno song and then moved in to the scoring. And now I'm done complaining about that, but I'm still mad.
No movie's perfect.
I think that one of the things I loved about the first one that contributed to me blowing my mind, and that the sequels did to a lesser extent, was the density of those little nuggets of WTFs that were going throughout it. Like I loved, like in the first film, it's filmed in Sydney, Australia, and so the city is all Sydney, but all the locational references are Chicago. And like whenever they talk about the street names, the subway stops, they're all Chicago. And so in that very first scene of the first film where it's the phone trace and you hear Trinity and Cypher talking, there's a phone number that pops up in the top left-hand corner, and the area code starts with a 3 and ends with a 2. And I suspect the middle number was a 1, which is a 312 area code, which Chicago. Is the central Chicago area code. And it's those kind of things that were so densely packed as blowing your mind that you go back a second, a third, or 9 times, Erica. And you're still discovering those new things. And while I enjoy it, because it's so richly dense, you can tell it's a film script that was and conceptual stuff that they had been building for years in order to develop it, that it's so full of those things. And then you get into the sequels again, which are still good, but they're not so densely packed with those WTF little nuggets that going back and rewatching reveals to you as you go through.
Yeah, they're definitely more sprawling.
I also really noticed the way gender is portrayed in the first movie versus the second, being that the first movie, even though we hardly see any, not very many women, but like there was sort of a bit of androgyny in how they were dressing, especially Neo and Trinity being dressed very similarly, which they are in the second movie as well.
Yeah, and Switch being very androgynous.
Yes, yes.
Well, we all know the background for what Switch was intended to be.
I don't.
Oh, okay. So Switch was originally written as assigned male at birth character in the real world, but then when could go into the Matrix would present as a woman, and that's how Switch was originally constructed by the Wachowskis, and Warner Brothers pushed back and you ended up with the more androgynous Switch character that is the same in both the real world and the Matrix. And so,
that's ooh, Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Because that's such an interesting take on the concept of when Morpheus says that what you look like in the Matrix is sort of your personal identity vision of yourself.
Yeah.
And so that would have been a very strong statement.
Yeah.
I think I was just thinking, Sarah, when you made that comment about the very rich multiple layers of the first film versus, you know, the script and the actual filmmaking of the second and third. It strikes me as a lot like in publishing. So a debut author will spend years and years and years on that first book because they had the time usually. But then, you know, they're on contract, if they're lucky, for a second book, and they don't have quite as much time, and they may not be able to do quite as much as they did with the first one. I think it's the same with a lot of musicians, right? And they talk mm-hmm. About the sophomore curse.
Second album syndrome.
Yeah, the sophomore curse, right? And then you don't have as much time, it's not as polished, and you're in a totally different headspace. So I think that might have been, you know, partly what's going on, and maybe the Wachowskis did lose their heads because they got so much more money. And they were like, wow, how can we spend this?
But they probably had more free reign as well, because like obviously Warner Brothers was making a lot of decisions for them on The Matrix. Mm. So they couldn't necessarily do all the things they wanted to. And I really feel like with the creators that I enjoy, I think I enjoy them the best and the most when they have rails, when they have an editor pushing back and saying, no, you know, you cannot write a book that is 1,000 pages long and just keeps going and going. Please, sir, cut it down, because it's always a dude. And so I feel like letting the Wachowskis sort of like, you know, off the leash, so to speak, to just run amok was a little bit, it was just too much for me. Like there was, you know, a couple fight scenes too many. I can't remember if it was the second movie, my favorite fight scene and that whole movie is where Neo comes and meets, I can't think of his name, again, lots of characters, but the guy who basically guards the Oracle.
Seraph. Yeah,
yeah, Seraph, thank you. So when he and Seraph, and basically this is just a very brief hand-to-hand fight, you know, up on some tables, maybe knocking some chopsticks down, and, you know, just really short and very intimate and personal. Yeah. And, like, that sequence is actually doing something. It's moving the characters forward. One character is testing another, and we are watching that play out in martial arts form. Whereas some of the other fight sequences and even the chase sequence, it's like that's not actually moving the plot forward. It's literally moving the characters forward. But the only thing that we needed to do in that case was we just need to get the keymaker keymaster, whatever his name is.
Keymaker.
And yeah, it's exciting, but it's not actually like moving. This is why action sequences of any kind generally tend to bore me, because I want character development while it's happening.
I totally respect that, Erica. Totally get it. And that's the opinion of lots and lots of, you know,
but it is well done. Like I will give them that.
And I'm just like, I just watched it because it's like, so what's gonna happen next? I'm not looking for some, you know, I wasn't looking for some deep anything. It's like, this is fun. You know, I'm just going to eat my popcorn. This is fun. But I mean, I totally get it. Like that whole sequence, the fight with Smith and Smith's in the playground. I bloody hate that scene.
No, it's too long.
That went for way too long.
I hate that scene so much.
Yeah, I get what they were doing with it. They were trying to show that he's like expanding to more and more programs, and he's spreading like a virus that he himself is. And I get that what it was doing, but God, that fight sequence went on for way too long.
Way too long.
Well, it's also more CGI as well.
Yes.
It's a cartoon.
And that did not age well. I'm sorry. No. This flying Neo is, that didn't work. That did not hold up.
No. I was like, are they trying to sell a video game? Is that what this whole scene is about? Because that's what it looked like.
Maybe.
It was terrible.
Because there was a video game that came out like, you know, right after the third movie that like follows right after. And apparently that's where Morpheus dies, which is apparently why Morpheus is not in the new movie or something, because he canonically died in a video game. Ouch. So
okay. Wow, welcome to Star Wars syndrome.
Yeah, I was like, I don't accept that.
One of the things that always struck me about for Trinity's line through the entire three films was that Neo becomes the one. and he surpasses everybody. But for the far majority of the first film, she is so much better at everything than he mm-hmm. is. Yep. Like, everything! Yeah. And it's like, and yet, like, she's supposed to bring him up, and he's the one that's supposed to be doing it. I'm on rewatch, no matter how much I love it, that always grates to me, because how many films have we seen, like, Aquaman. where the woman character was so much better suited for the role than the male character was. Even though I get the storyline that all the things that I was talking about earlier, about like why she was there as a device for him. But yeah, I'm constantly feeling like, oh my God, you're so much better than he is. Why are you supporting him to do this thing?
I think that's just a fundamental problem with the Chosen One narrative is, which is, you know, a thing that I think is becoming less and less popular these days, that you've got this one person who is set way above everybody else. And I mean, for a long time, the default gender for a hero was always it's going to be a guy. So you need to have somebody showing them the ropes, and whoever that is going to start out being better at those ropes than they are, regardless of what their gender is. And because we needed the love story here, it's got to be a woman. So it doesn't make me any more comfortable with it. But like, I recognize from a Doyleist perspective instead of the Watsonian perspective, like I recognize why it happened that way. But it still makes me sad every time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel the same way. I can get the reasons why they do it. And, but so much of like the times where I'm like, I love her as a character, she becomes a device to move him forward. And that's the moments where I'm like, oh.
Every fave is problematic somehow.
Yes, yeah. Every fave is problematic. Yeah, it's true.
Nothing's perfect. It's impossible.
Well, and it is set in like with being that 90s era where every time the female characters want to do something, they always get pushed back on doing it, where it's like, well, you know, Trinity wants to go with Neo. Link's wife wants to fight at the dock. And even, is it the pilot?
Niobe.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, she gets pushed back all the time when she's trying to make decisions and stuff every time she does something. And
as the only
kind
woman
of works.
Pilot.
Yeah, but it's like every time they have to like kind of stake their ground and fight for doing what everyone else is doing. And I like that in the end they get to do it, because I think that's kind of where we were in the 90s, where it's like we have to push through and then we'll be able to do it. But it would be really nice if we didn't have to like fight to do things.
I do have to say though, for the character of Neo and the relationship between Neo and Trinity, I love the fact that when she says, I'm coming with you, he doesn't try to talk her out of it. He actually is like, I was going to ask you to come along anyway. Like, it's just taken as a given. These two are a team and they are going to go together. Even though in my head, I'm like, he's the one. You realize you're going to die. Why would you go with him? But of course, they're in love, and
maybe
she
obviously
they
are the one.
Really important. well, that was maybe we'll find that out at Christmas.
Well, we've got like Trinity, which is three, Neo, who's one. I'm kind of always headcanoned Morpheus as two. And that was the thing that always played in my head, was like, Trinity is three. It's obvious, she's three. Neo is the one. And the obvious lack of a two in there is that Morpheus? Is that someone else?
Because now we've got Cypher as a zero. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
So many ways.
Yep.
That's always been a thing that's been flying around in my head. We have the one and we have the three.
Maybe the two are the directors.
Oh,
because there's two of them and they're a team.
Well, and they're so decidedly precise in so many things in that first movie that it wouldn't be unusual for this to be a question they want us to ask.
Yeah, it's glaring. I mean, it's rather glaring to me that like it's glaring in its obvious lack of an answer, that it's not there.
Or maybe you as the audience member are supposed to be the second person in this relationship.
A first person versus third person versus second
person. Yeah, right? Like, yeah, right. You, yeah. Second person, you are actually in the Matrix, but you don't recognize it.
You're blowing my mind.
Oh, no, it's worse because you think about it, you're breaking the fourth wall.
And this whole, the whole concept of this is breaking the fourth wall.
The entire thing is about breaking the fourth wall.
Yep. Dun, whoa. Dun, dun. Mind blown again.
I'm going to ignore all those people that don't understand the Matrix now because it totally is a head trip. It really is.
There's and I feel like a lot of people too who either just kind of watched it and enjoyed it and moved along at the time, or people who are watching it now, like they haven't had the impulse that we have to just dig down into all of this stuff and think about that, because you can absolutely watch The Matrix and think, hey, that's a fun action movie with some fight scenes and, you know, kind of a cool science fictiony thing where they're, you know, they have a ship that floats and stuff, yeah, that's cool, and then just kind of like wander off and not think about it again. But as you guys have said again and again, like the layers and the depth of this movie, there's a lot of layers there to dig down through if you want to take the time to do that, which clearly we do.
Yes. I mean, God, I just like, I mean, shifting from the complex to the banal, I want a smart banana phone. I just like, I want to be able to like open it up and go thunk and have a phone that does that for me, because I remember seeing that phone and just desiring it in a way that I'd never desired a phone. Never ended up getting it, but God, I wanted that phone.
It was not available in the United States at the time. I was very, very sad.
It was a Nokia, wasn't it?
A Nokia one. And it was definitely available in Europe and certainly in like the Nordic countries. I know it was available in like Sweden and Finland and stuff. And I was like, can I order a phone from that far away? No, I absolutely cannot. That's not a thing that I am. Even if I could do it, I wouldn't know how to make it work because I was not very technologically savage. But I just had another thought about like your numbers. Thanks, Sarah. Okay. So Cypher, he's the zero because he's the bad guy. Neo is number one. Trinity is number three. What is trying to keep Neo and Trinity apart? The two agents that work with Agent Smith. We're leaving Agent Smith out of this because he's different. So
he is the flip side to Neo. So that's how he's positioned. But yeah,
so there you go.
Wow, you can see signs everywhere, like in the like in the area code you mentioned, Sarah.
Yeah,
312.
Yes.
Oh, Sandra. Oh, that's so
mind
good.
Blown again.
Oh my God. Oh, wow. Okay,
I'm never
so going to cool.
sleep again.
This is so good.
I just want to go and watch him again now.
Yes, me too. I'll come over and we'll watch him together.
We need to have a marathon. Sandra, you're invited too if you want to come.
Oh, thank you.
Sarah, you're invited.
Yeah.
You can
if I can make it. Like, it's only a few thousand miles. It'll be fine. Yeah.
Oh, I want to go back to something Sandra said earlier because it relates to our mission. But you said this movie is about a love, which I think it's beyond romantic love. Mm-hmm. Also, because Neo is love and Agent Smith is hatred. He's like completely becomes consumed by hatred, which is so interesting because he's supposed to be emotionless. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and love as a concept, a grand concept, comes up a lot, especially in the second two movies, coming from the Oracle and like the sacrifice for love, the things we do for love.
And love is the variable that the architect can absolutely not wrap its mind around.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. And that is the core, because we also see that with Sati?
Yes, the little girl.
And they have that conversation in the between subway station about what is love. Love is a word. A word for a concept. I'm going to 100% agree. That's so much a part of the second two films. It's various forms of love, and love being the operating concept for that eventually not takes down the Matrix, but frees it in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. I think, especially from the conversations between Neo and the Oracle about choice.
Yes.
So I think that Entwined, for me, Entwined is, yes, this overarching theme about love, but related to that and entwined with that is this idea of choice. So I love what the Oracle says, right? That you've already made the choice. You just need to understand it. And that is a lot about what, how love drives us as human beings. We know what we want. And sometimes we'll make the choice based on love if we're lucky. But we don't really understand it at sometimes a level that we need to, that our brain needs to catch up to our hearts. And I just love how so many times I think you see people making choices out of love, like Z choosing to stay and fight because she loves Link and she's not going to abandon him. Like in her heart, she would be abandoning him if she evacuated, right? So I love this idea. I love this idea. I love the idea of how human beings make choices. And sometimes they're good choices for us. Sometimes they're bad choices for us. But how many of them are driven by love? Or for me, the flip side would be fear. Mm. And I think the thing that's missing from Smith, because we know that programs can love, like Sati's parents and Sati herself. So programs can love. They have that variable too in this world. But Smith cannot. He does not understand. And so all he is he makes no choices. He just does what he is programmed to do as a virus. He cannot do anything but that because he cannot grasp that variable. He has no concept. It just literally does not compute. And I think that's really interesting for me, thematically speaking. I just love that.
The Oracle also says you cannot see, she says this about herself, but in general, you cannot see beyond the choice you don't understand as well.
That's right.
And I was like, I like that concept as well, where you already made the choice because it's so instinctual and it comes out of your emotions and feelings and thinking, but you can't see beyond it until you understand why you're making that choice. And you have to go back and sit and think about why you're making that choice. And I'm like, I like that concept.
Yeah.
It's also a really nice get out of jail free card for the writers to not have to give everything away.
Right. Because that's sort of boring from an Oracle perspective. Mm-hmm. It's like they know everything and don't tell you, like, that seems lame.
Mm-hmm. But in this case.
That also, that point you're making about choice, Sandra, is really important because I think you got the Merovingian and his, I mean, it's like his pretentious piece of, anyway, I swear.
Frenchman.
I kind of knew guys like him in university. Oh, God. He's terrible. But anyway, he had all his speeches about cause and effect, but he never talks about choice. He just says cause and effect. And so in a way, he's trapped in this older version of the Matrix where choice is not a part of things. And so whenever Trinity, Neo make a choice, he's always taken aback. He's always working reactively because he can't make a choice himself, and they constantly refer to him as being around from some of the older versions of the Matrix, and it's just like this idea that like you can't account for choice.
But on the other hand, he is there with his wife, who's also, like, they're both from the previous version of the Matrix, and she's able to make choices just fine. And so I think it's more that he is just, he doesn't need to think about the world in terms of choice for a similar reason, I think, to why Agent Smith doesn't, because he has everything he thinks he could need. He's like, you know, your stereotypical, you know, Musk-like billionaire who just like doesn't really think about the things that they do, just does whatever feels like it comes naturally because I am owed this, because I am me, and that's just the way that the world around me works. And I love the fact that Persephone is just sick of it, so she makes a choice, and her choice completely upends things so much that it really gets the better of the Merovingian a bit. And that's certainly, like, that doesn't break them up. In fact, it probably added some spice to their relationship for a while, just based on what their relationship looked like from the outside. Exactly. But that was another interesting semi-romantic relationship within the context of this, because yeah, they're programs, but they're married and they're programs, and they but one of is still feeling jealousy at and anger and annoyance at her partner because he's such a jerk. It's like, you go, girl. But she's still really not like good. She's not redeemed in any way, because she still shows up in the third movie as sitting right by his side and not being particularly helpful.
And interestingly, though, they've chosen to stay together. Is that what you were going to say, Sarah?
Oh, no, something similar. It was like her her choices are serving herself in the same way that the Merovingian's inability to choose, he just does what he wants. She was doing what she wanted. She wasn't making a choice to help Neo and Trinity and Morpheus. So her choice was to
annoy her partner.
It's like they just happened to be the, that's like Trinity, Neo and Morpheus just happened to be the vehicle through which she could do that. And
and she's doing it because she doesn't feel his love. Right? She's like feeling unloved and unconnected. And if he had been connected to her, she would not be making choices to basically undermine him and get his attention. I think that's why she does it. It's because she wants love.
And the fact that she makes Neo kiss her as if she, and make to make her feel like she's Trinity. Like she's jonesing for some loving. You're right. Love.
Yeah. But she chooses to stay with him and he chooses to stay with her. So that's interesting too, right? I mean, the choices that they made in some previous iteration of the Matrix that we don't know anything about. I don't know. I just love this thinking about choice and then applying it to human beings. do we choose, right? And what do we choose from? Do we choose from love? Do we choose from fear? Do we choose from hatred? Do we choose from wide open possibility, you know, and curiosity? Like, that is all available. And I think that in the stories that we're talking about in these three films, it's a very tight world in that there's a very specific things that need to happen. But that's the nature of drama, right? You want to heighten the stakes so that things are interesting for the times that they're interesting. But I really do think that the Wachowskis are trying to say something about being human. And that's why there's the juxtaposition against or with the machines. And I just want to bring this up while I remember, which is I've always been struck by how when the humans are jacked into the Matrix and they're in their Matrix persona, they are like machines. They act like they have no emotions. They try to have their expressions are like blank, bland. They hide their eyes, which are the windows to the soul, behind sunglasses and shades. I always have found that really interesting, that when they're in the Matrix, they act like machines. And which is such a beautiful juxtaposition to their lives in Zion or on the ships, in the real world, the destroyed world, where they're just messy. They're messy and things are just like weird and gross and, you know, like they're just human.
But Neo's superpower is basically embracing the system and becoming even more of the machine. So he is essentially a program who can break all the rules set for humans. Like, that's sort of his superpower.
Which is why I think he's not messy in the real world in the same way that a lot of the people around him are. Like, he's still contained. The same whichever side of the Matrix wall he's on, because he's the one.
The one. The one. The one. I'm hearing echoes in my head. Every time you say, the one. The one. Anyway.
Speaking of smooch and romance and stuff, we also have a love triangle if we want to talk about romantic tropes.
Oh, because, yes.
Yeah, we get Jada Pinkett Smith as Niobe, who used to be with Morpheus and isn't anymore. Now she's with Commander Locke, and it's just like it's only really just sort of surface touched on, but like I would 100% watch the, you know, side miniseries that's just them three. Like, how did that happen? What were they like as youngsters? You know, how did they break apart? Well, we know what broke them apart. It was because Morpheus went to see the Oracle and became Morpheus. So I would probably dump him too, but still.
Yeah. I mean, some things change and some things stay the same.
It was a choice.
Yeah, it was a choice. Yeah, you've made a choice.
And they still love each other because of the embrace at the end, it's where they care about each other. But I don't sense that that is the beginning of her leaving her husband. It's just sort of an acknowledgement of they still care, but he's still Morpheus.
I don't know. I thought I felt like her husband was so ticked off at her that their splitsville. I didn't necessarily think she was getting back together with Morpheus, but I definitely thought that she was like, okay, I am done with you, stick in the mud.
Yeah, that was my takeaway. It was, I didn't necessarily think she was getting back with Morpheus, but she was done with the the general.
Lock.
Commander.
Lock. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Commander Lock.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think we see her in the trailer, don't we?
Yes, she's coming back in four.
Yay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Excitement.
And we do actually have a Morpheus in
yes,
in number four, but it's a younger Morpheus?
Version. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
equally handsome.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is a good time to segue to a question I want to ask, which is, what do you think is going to happen? Because essentially, at the end of this, they're kind of look dead, both Trinity and Neo, but clearly they're not dead. We're back in the Matrix. And
well, also, we have Sati asking at the end of the third movie, do you think I would like to see Neo again? Do you think we'll see him? And the Oracle says, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yes.
So they left that open.
Yeah, definitely. And like, we didn't, we like kind, yeah, I guess she had a bunch of like things poking out of her, but it's the future. They could bring her back.
I mean, clones?
my theory.
Your headcanon.
My headcanon is that Cypher wanted to be reinserted into the Matrix, but he wanted it to be done in such a way that he forgets everything, that he knows nothing of the real world. And I think that's happened to both Trinity and... And Neo, that they've been plugged back in and they know nothing of the real world. And it's the Matrix sleeps, but slipping back through, even because they haven't properly wiped them. Because remember, you need the anomaly to be present in the Matrix to correct the Matrix. So if they could insert Neo back into the Matrix in order to make it more stable, but have him not realize that he would want to get out again. That's my theory.
I was certainly with you at the beginning. Like, I do think that they probably just both got reinserted, and I will be interested to see if that's the case. Like, how exactly do they hand wave it to make it that they were wiped? Because like at the end of the third movie, it's very clear that all of humanity is being given a choice. They can choose to leave the Matrix. They can choose to stay in the Matrix. Like, so are we supposed to think that if Trinity and Neo are inserted, did they make the choice to stay, or was that choice taken away from them for some reason? And if so, what is that reason? I'm not sure I necessarily believe at this point that the anomaly is required, because things have changed so much. Like, the Matrix is not what it once was. It certainly doesn't have as many people in it, because they're about to lose a lot of power. Because I hope that they would let people leave the Matrix at the end of the third movie, like in shifts, because I don't think Zion can like.
Yeah, I had that exact thought. Was like, oh my god, if billion people decide to quit the Matrix all at the same time, Zion is kind of screwed.
Yeah, and the Machine City is at the same time too. So like that would not be great. But I do like, that was my first thought, was that yes, they have been reinserted into the Matrix. You know, perhaps because, you know, their wounds, certainly Trinity's, were so bad that the only way to heal her is to put her in naked in a vat of goo and plug her in again and like feed vitamins directly into her system for probably years upon end. Like, I can very easily see that being the reason that Trinity needed to go back in the Matrix. And, you know, maybe Neo does make a choice to go back in the Matrix because he knows the Trinity's there, but why would he choose not to remember anything? I don't know. I'm terrible at guessing, so I'm just really excited to see what they tell me, and then I will judge them.
Well, I have the feeling they haven't shown us a lot, because like they sort of basically set a tone and they show us that they're back in the Matrix and that they have an affinity for each other, and we've got Neil Patrick Harris doing the psychology thing, and they talk about like the blue pills being like medication, and but I have the feeling that could be like the first half hour of the movie, and that they've actually told us very, I hope that's what's happening.
Yeah.
Well, there was one of the things that, it's like one of the breakdowns that I saw was that they had a zoom in on the pill bottle that, Neo is holding in that one scene in the trailer. And the pill type is something called, ontologifloxacin or something like that. And ontology, which is, and that was the idea, was that you have ontology, which is the nature of reality and the building blocks of being. And it's literally a blue pill. And nice. And I thought, okay, if we're going to get that level of layers again, I'm here for this.
Yes. Because him making the choice to stay Matrix again and again, like every day by taking that blue pill, it's like that is a mind trip. I think they're doing a good job with the marketing, and I hope that we don't see a longer trailer with a lot more information.
Yes.
I don't want that.
The joys of the first movie was going in not knowing anything, and I would really like to go into this one nearly as cold.
Yeah, me too.
I want to find out what's up with the rubber duck.
Oh, I love that picture of him in the tub with the, like, I could just.
I just gave me that.
Mike, that makes me happy. I'm also, after watching the movies again, I hope Sati shows up.
Oh, yeah. Well, the theory is that and you get that flash of a woman closing a book of Alice in Wonderland. And she is a woman of South Asian descent, and the rumor is that is Sati. And
that would make sense.
And there's theories about what she is, but I'm not going to ruin it for Erica.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm totally like, I totally don't care. I don't even care. I'm just going to watch it at some point, you know? So
it may be the thing that gets me back into a theater.
We will reconvene after we've all seen this movie. And then we will discuss it again.
Yeah, what it means for the trio and Neo and Trinity.
I look forward to some actual, like, steamy romantic chemistry between those two actors, because I feel like at this point they could probably do it and might do it better than I don't know. It just, something was off then. But, like, I've seen them both in so many things since then, and they're good. Mm-hmm. Like, they can actually act.
I think they've had, what, 2 decades more plus of acting experience since then. And I think that's like, I like, this was Carrie Ann Moss's first major role.
It was.
And while Keanu Reeves had been around for a while, they're still babies. And I think they've had a couple decades of acting experience. And I think their acting skills are going to be better in this film.
I even noticed that between the first and the second set, that like Keanu Reeves fighting a building was like much more honed by the second time. Like, there was just some things, like they did such a great job with what they did, but in the second movies, you can tell they've been doing some training.
He'd been continuing to train since the first movie, which is impressive.
Well, and now with all of his other experience in a lot of like action films,
action movies,
like, come on.
Yeah, who would have pegged Keanu Reeves as an action star when you were watching, like, My Own Private Idaho? Like, what?
Oh, I totally did. He could do anything. That was my... No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I was very realistic that he was... Actually, the first film I ever saw him in was some low-budget Canadian film where he was the teenage romantic interest for a teen gymnast. I have no idea what this film was called. I could probably try and find out, but I don't care quite that much. And he was not awesome.
Not everybody starts awesome.
He was a baby. You can find videos, and I posted a few too on my Twitter now and then, of when Keanu Reeves hosted a CBC Kids show way back in the 80s. There's one you can find of him at a teddy bear convention. Oh my god!
I've seen that.
It's just so cute.
It's ridiculous.
Well, I just think it's of silly. Carrie Ann Moss in Jessica Jones, and how downright scary she was in that TV series, I guess. Yeah, and like how good her acting was in Jessica Jones, and I mean, she's not bad in The Matrix, but how much better she was in the likes of.
I remember watching her in Chocolat, and I thought she was pretty good. I mean, she had to be in that, you know, opposite Judi Dench. So I thought she did pretty well.
I feel like this is a good time to give everyone.
Because we've moved on to other movies.
Yes, we have. Yeah. Our final thoughts, and then we will go watch. Our homework is to go watch the new movie, and we will come back and do part two. Final thoughts, Sarah.
I reminded myself of just how much I love this and enjoy. I mean, and yeah, maybe as Erica is mentioning, it's because it hit me as a Gen Xer at a particular moment in time, and it blew my mind in a way that few other films since have, and or even before then. And it's always going to stick as like that moment in time for me, and going and transporting me back there. So it's got problems, but I'm always going to love it beyond anything.
Sandra?
Well, I think I would like to say for anyone who is going to rewatch it or maybe watch it for the first time is to keep in mind those themes of love and choice. And I also think of this trilogy as like a version of a coming of age film. I know mm-hmm. that there's that whole chosen one trope, but I really feel like it's a coming of age story at some level too for Neo, and also about ontology, the nature of being. And what is that? How mm-hmm. do you navigate that when you think you're in a world that gives you no choices, nothing but bad choices? I just love like the depth that's possible if you really want to stop and think about it. But above all else, this trilogy is about love and what we can do in the name of love. And why we do the things we do when we are in love. So there.
That is good. How about for you, Erica?
I think that I can't wait to watch them again. And I really can't wait to watch the new movie. Like the little tiny breadcrumbs that we have been given in that first little trailer make it look like the movie might be retreading some or a lot of the same ground as the first movie. And part mm-hmm. of me is like, well, you know, that could be, Annette, like you said, just the first half hour and then we get into other stuff. Or maybe it's not. And you know what? I don't care either way because I love that first movie so much that even if they decided to just retread it, but do it from a slightly, you know, skewed, canted angle, you know, making it feel more like it's, you know, something created today as opposed to back in 1999, I would be perfectly happy with that. But when it comes to the first movie, I think my rewatch experience has taught me two things. And one is, as I said before, I really enjoy the two sequels, Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. I like them. I'm firmly in that camp now. And also, I think that The Matrix, the first movie, might now have joined the ranks of being tied for my favorite movie of all time. So wow. That's wow. Like, what's it's the tie? A big thing to say. Well, it was a two-way tie for many years between Labyrinth, starring David Bowie.
And, yes. Yep, of course.
And Lawrence of Arabia, starring Peter my. O'Toole.
Really?
Find wow. me two more different movies. But yeah, so those are my two favorites. And I think I'm just adding a science fiction film here, The Matrix. So it's a trifecta nice. Now. Yep. This is nice. The official right, announcement.
One,
you heard it
one
here first.
Might say a trinity.
Trinity.
Ah, yes! One might.
Oh, my.
I'm going to just say that I'm with Sarah on the... Like, I went watching this movie again, which I haven't for a few years, but when you watch a movie like this that I know so well that, and yet there's so many things that just delight me and intrigue me, but it sort of takes me back. And I think that's part of what makes me feel so good watching it is it's like I have that experience again every time I watch it, even though I know everything that's going to happen and there's no secrets anymore. Mm-hmm. But it just... Yeah, it just is so good. And I'm sure it's one of the movies I've seen the most times, up there with a few others. But yeah, I just know this movie so well. And I feel like I need to watch the sequels more often because
yeah.
I always felt a little sheepish about. I was like, but I don't think I hate them. I was like, I think they're just not as good as the first one.
Yeah, join the fold. Come join us.
I was not alone. I just didn't find my people, and we didn't talk about that. Because I own all of them on DVD.
Me too.
Yeah, me too.
I'm the odd one. I got rid of almost all of my DVDs when I moved from the States to Canada, so I've been out.
Oh, okay. Sandra, I have you covered.
Yeah, mine are ripped. I ripped them. Yes.
Yes. Well, we will leave it here, and we will come back sometime, probably in the new year, to talk about the sequel. But I'm so excited to go watch it. And in the meantime, stay safe, agents. Agents of Smooch is part of the Incomparable Network. If you are enjoying our show, please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the Smooch Agency, you can become a member of the Incomparable at theincomparable.com/members. Members can choose to support us and any other shows on the network, and you get extra perks like hanging out in the members-only Slack channel and bonus content such as our growing list of incomprehensible Agents of Smooch tipsy commentaries. Thank you for listening. Your next mission will be coming to you soon.